told my husband to do all he can, and he thinks he's got it hemmed up for you.
Ooh, what is it?
It is a lady's maid job. She is a singer down at the theater where he is electrician. She brought a maid with her from up north, but the maid met up with a lot of colored people and looks like she's going to get married right off. She don't want the job no more. The lady asked the men around the theater to get her somebody, and my husband thought about you, and I told him to tell the rest of the men he had just the right girl for a maid. It seems like she is a mighty nice person. I was too excited to sit still. I was frightened, too, because I did not know the first thing about being a lady's maid. All I hoped was that the lady would overlook that part and give me a chance to catch on. You gotta look nice for that, so I sent Valina down to buy you a little dress. Valina was her daughter. It's cheap, but it's neat and stylish. Go inside Valina's room and try it on. The dress was of navy blue poplin, with a box-pleated skirt and a little round white collar. To my own self, I never did look so pretty before. I put on the dress and Valina's dark blue felt hat with a rolled brim. She saw to it that I shined my shoes, and then gave me car fare and sent me off with every bit of advice she could think of. My feet mounted up the golden stairs as I entered the stage door of that theater. The sounds, the smells, the backstage jumble of things were all things to bear me up into a sweeter atmosphere. I felt like dancing towards the dressing room when it was pointed out to me. But my friend was walking with me, coaching me how to act, and I had to be as quiet and sober as could be. The matinee performance of HMS Pinafore was on, so I was told to wait. In a little while, a tenor and a soprano voice quit singing a duet, and a beautiful blonde girl of about 22 came hurrying into the dressing room. I waited until she went inside and closed the door, then I knocked and was told to come in. She looked at me and smiled so hard till she almost laughed. "Hello, little girl," she chanted. "Where did you come from?"
"Home. I come to see you."
"Oh, you did? That's fine. What did you come to see me about?"
"I come to work for you."
"Work for me?" She threw back her head and laughed. That frightened me a great deal. Maybe it was all a joke and there was no job after all. "Doing what?" she caroled on.
"Be your lady's maid."
"You? Why, how old are you?"
20,
I said, and tried to look serious as I had been told, but she laughed so hard at that till I forgot and laughed too. "Oh, no, you are not 20. She laughed some more, but it was not scornful laughter, just bubbling fun. "Well, 18 then," I compromised. "No, not 18 either." "Well then, how about 16? She laughed at that. Instead of frowning in a sedate way, as I had been told, here I was laughing like a fool myself. "I don't believe you are 16, but I'll let it go at that," she said. "Next birthday, honest." "It's all right, you're hired. But let's don't bring this age business up again. I think I'm going to like you. What is your name?" I told her, fearing all the time she was going to ask questions about my family, but she didn't. "Well, Zora, I pay $10 a week and expenses. You think that will do?" I almost fell over. $10 each and every week? Was there that much money in the world, sure enough? Comprestability. It wouldn't take long for me to own a bank at that rate. "Yes, ma'am," I shouted. "Well, change my shoes for me." She stuck out her foot and pointed at the pair she wanted to put on. I got them on with her tickling me in the back. She showed me a white dress she wanted to change into, and I jumped to get it and hook it up. She touched up her face, laughing at me in the mirror, and dashed out. I was crazy about her right then. I washed out her shoelaces from a pair of white shoes and her stockings, which were on the back of a chair, and wrung them out in a bath towel for quick drying, and sat down before the mirror to look at myself. It was truly wonderful. So I had to examine all the curious cosmetics on the table. I was sort of trying them out when she came in. That night, she let me stand in the wings and hear her sing her duet with the tenor. Farewell, my own. Light of my life, farewell. It was so beautiful to me that she seemed more than human. Everything was pleasing and exciting. If there was any more to heaven than this, I didn't want to see it. I did not go back home, that is, to my brother's house, at all. I was afraid he would try to keep me. I slept on a cot in the room with Valina. She was almost as excited as I was, had come down to see me every night, and had met the cast. We were important people, she and I. Her mother had to make us shut up talking and go to sleep every night. The end of the enchanted week came, and the company was to move on. Miss M, whom I was serving, asked me about my clothes and luggage. She told me not to come down to the train with an old dilapidated suitcase, for that would make her ashamed. So the upshot of it was that she advanced me the money to buy one, and then paid me for the week. I paid my friend the $6 which she had spent for my new dress. Valina gave me the hat, an extra pair of panties and stockings. I bought a comb and brush and toothbrush, paste, and two handkerchiefs. Miss M did not know when I came down to the station that morning that my new suitcase was stuffed with newspapers to keep my things from rattling. The company, a Gilbert and Sullivan repertoire, had its own coach. That was another glory to dazzle my eyes. The leading man had a valet, and the contralto had an English maid, both white. I was the only Negro around. But that did not worry me in the least. I had no chance to be lonesome because the company welcomed me like, or as, a new play pretty. It did not strike me as curious then. I never even thought about it. Now I can see the reason for it. In the first place, I was a Southerner and had the map of Dixie on my tongue. They were all Northerners except the orchestra leader who came from Pensacola. It was not that my grammar was bad, it was the idioms. They did not know of the way an average Southern child, white and black, is raised on simile and invective. They know how to call names. It is an everyday affair to hear somebody called a mullet-headed, mule-eared, wall-eyed, hog-nosed, gator-faced, shad-mouthed, screw-necked, goat-bellied, puzzle-gutted, camel-backed, butt-sprung, battle-hammed, knock-kneed, razor-legged, box-ankled, shovel-footed, unmated so-and-so. Eyes looking like skint ginny nuts, and mouth looking like a dishpan full of broke-up crockery. They can tell you in simile exactly how you walk and smell. They can furnish a picture gallery of your ancestors and a notion of what your children will be like. What ought to happen to you is full of images and flavor. Since that stratum of the Southern population is not given to book reading, they take their comparisons right out of the barnyard and the woods. When they get through with you, you and your whole family look like an acre of totem poles. First thing, I was young and green, so the baritone started out teasing me the first day. He waylaid me down the coach aisle away from Miss M and told me I looked like a nice girl and he wanted to help me out. He was going to tell me just how to get along. I was very glad and thanked him. He told me to sit down by him and let him give me a few pointers. I did, and he asked me a few very ordinary questions about where I was born and so on. Very sober-faced. All of a sudden he yelled so the whole coach could hear him. Porter! A flock of hand towels and a 7 o'clock call! Nearly everybody burst out laughing. I couldn't see what for. I knew the joke was on me somehow, but I didn't know what it was. I sat there blank-faced, and that made them laugh more. Miss M did not laugh. She called me and told me to sit down by her and not to listen to dirty cracks. Finally, she let me know what the joke was. Then I jumped up and told that man to stop trying to run the hog over me. That set everybody off again. They teased me all the time just to hear me talk, but there was no malice in it. If I got mad and spoke my piece, they liked it even better. I was stuffed with ice cream sodas and Coca-Cola. Another reason was that it was fun to them to get hold of somebody whom they could shock. I was hurt to my heart because the company manager called me into his dressing room and asked me how I liked my job. After I got through telling him how pleased I was, he rushed out with his face half made up, screaming, "Stop! Oh, Zora, please stop! Shame on you telling me a dirty story like that! Oh, I have never been so shocked in all my life!" Heads popped out of dressing rooms all over. Groans, sad head shakings, and murmurs of outrage. Sad, sad. They were glad I had not told them such a thing. Too bad, too bad. Not a smile in the crowd. The more I tried to explain, the worse it got. Some locked their doors to shield their ears from such contamination. Finally, Miss M broke down and laughed and told me what the gag was. For a long while, nobody could get me inside a dressing room outside of Miss M's, but that didn't stop the teasing. They would think up more, like having one of the men contrive to walk down the aisle with me, and then everybody lift shocked eyebrows, pretend to blush and wink at each other and sigh, "Zora, Zora, what would your mother say?" I would be so upset that I wouldn't know what to do. Maybe they really believed I wasn't nice. Another sly trick they played on my ignorance was that some of the men would call me and with a very serious face send me to some of the girls to ask about the welfare and condition of Cherries and Spangles. They would give me a tip and tell me to hurry back with the answer. Some of the girls would send back word that the men need not worry their heads at all. They would never know the first thing about the condition of their Cherries and Spangles. Some of the girls sent answers full of double talk which went over my head. The soubrette spoke her mind to the men about that practice, and it stopped. But none of this had malice in it, just their idea of good backstage gags. By the time they stopped, it seemed that I was necessary to everybody. I was continually stuffed with sweets, nut meats, and soft drinks. I was welcome in everybody's coach seat, and the girls used to pitch pennies to see who carried me off to their hotel rooms. We played games and told stories. They often ordered beer and pretzels, but nobody offered me a drink. I heard all about their love affairs and troubles. They were all looking forward to playing or singing leads someday. Some great personage had raved about all of their performances. The dirty producers and casting directors just hadn't given them their chance. Miss M finally put a stop to my going off with the others as soon as she was ready for bed. I had to stay wherever she stayed after that. She had her own affairs to talk about. She paid for a course for me in manicuring, and I practiced on everybody until I became very efficient at it. That course came in handy to me later on. With all this petting, I became as cocky as a sparrow on Fifth Avenue. I got a scrapbook, and everybody gave me a picture to put in it. I pasted each one on a separate page and wrote comments under each picture. This created a great deal of interest because some of the comments were quite pert. They egged me on to elaborate. Then I got another idea. I would comment on daily doings and post the sheets on the call board. This took on right away. The results stayed strictly mine less than a week because members of the cast began to call me aside and tell me things to put in about others. It got to be so general that everybody was writing it. It was just my handwriting mostly. Then it got beyond that. Most of the cast ceased to wait for me. They would take a pencil to the board and set down their own item. Answers to the wisecracks would appear promptly and often cause uproarious laughter. They always started off with either Zora says or the observant reporter of the call board asserts. Lord, Zora said more things. I was continually astonished, but always amused. There were, of course, some sly digs at supposedly secret love affairs at times, but no vicious thrusts. Everybody enjoyed it, even the victims. This hilarious game came to a sudden end. The company manager had been a member of the cast. One day, he received a telegram offering him a fat part in a Broadway show, and of course, he left us. So a new manager was sent on from New York. Somehow, he struck everybody wrong from the start. The baritone, who was always quick on the draw, said he looked like he had been soaked in greasy dishwater and had not been wiped off. Even Miss M, who seldom cracked, said he reminded her of the leftovers from the stockyards. His trousers sagged at the knees, so I named him Old Bustle Knees. His name was Smith, but he became known on the quiet as BK. He was on the make. You could see that the moment he landed, and you had to give him credit for ambition. He gave Miss M the first chance to be his love life for the duration. She snooted him as if he were actually a slaughterhouse byproduct. He kept on down the line until he did actually land a lady of the ensemble who had visions of becoming a lead, if not actually a star. It hurt everybody, Helen's defection, for she had been very popular. It must have hurt her, too, because she used to come in and leave the theater at his heels with her eyes away from everybody, usually leading BK's fox terrier on a leash. That was her symbol of office. But having gained a heart interest did not seem to satisfy him. He took a bitter hatred of Miss M to his heart to nurse. He pulled every nasty, annoying trick on her that he could think of to humiliate her. Therefore, it was decided to give him an entire issue of the call board. The name of Smith was not in the publication, but Bustle Knees was, and no punches were pulled. It took nearly all night and half of the next day to rub it up until it glittered. Everybody had a hand in it except our lost Helen, the fox terrier, and Smith. Some stage hands even put in their nickel's worth. By the time we got through, he looked like a forest full of primitive demon masks with a pacing gait. When he read it, he was as hot as seven hells with West Hell and Ginny Gall thrown in. It was all in my handwriting, so he couldn't fire anybody. But he could and did forbid any papers to appear on the call board again. Nothing but official notices. He told Miss M that I had to be fired, but she refused him flat even after he said he knew I had named him Bustle Knees. So we knew that Helen had told him that. He had that name before she had gone over to him. But our suffering did not last more than 6 weeks. He had the temerity to juggle the box office reports to his own profit and got fired. The last I saw of him was one night after the stage was struck. There was a single bare bulb as if for rehearsal on stage, and he was standing by it, his hands shoved far down in his overcoat pockets, looking like first one soggy thing and then another. Helen was offside, standing very still in the shadows, shifting the dog's leash from hand to hand. The next day, we were enjoying his space more than we ever had his company. Helen went to bed with a sick stomach. Not long after that, the run came to an end. Miss M had a part in another show all set, but rehearsals would not start for 2 weeks. So she took me to her home in Boston, and I found out some things which I did not want to know particularly. At times, she had been as playful as a kitten. At others, she would be solemn and moody. She loved her mother excessively, but when she received those long, wordy letters from her, she read them with a still face and tore them up carefully. Then she would be gloomy and keep me beside her every minute. Sometimes she would become excessively playful. It was puzzling to see a person cry a while and then commence to romp like a puppy and keep it up for hours. Sometimes she had to have sherry before she went to bed after a hard romp with me. She invented a game for us to play in our hotel room. It was known as Jake. She would take rouge and paint her face all over a most startling red. Then I must take eyeshadow and paint myself blue. Blue Jake and Red Jake would then chase each other into closets, across beds, into bathrooms with our sheet robes trailing around us and tripping us up at odd moments. We crouched and growled and ambushed each other and laughed and yelled until we were exhausted. Then maybe next day she hardly said a word. Of course, the members of her family had been described to me often. Her mother had been married 3 times. There had been 4 children by the first very early marriage, but only the oldest one, John, was alive. He was a man around 40 now and never had been married. He didn't work regularly, but was very jolly and obliging. Another brother, Charlie, about 12 years younger than Johnny, was a city fireman in Boston. He had 2 children. He was a son of the second marriage. Miss M was 8 years younger than Charlie and had a different father. When I got to their home in the outskirts of Boston, I saw that the old lady had made improvements as she went along. Johnny, her firstborn, was homely. One thing struck me forcibly. His teeth had either not come out of his gums very far or they had been sawed off. Charlie was a big, robust Irishman who was not very handsome, but not bad at all. He would do nicely. Miss M was a startling blonde beauty, no less. She was doing rather well as a singer. Charlie was getting on in the fire department, and their older brother was just named Johnny. This Johnny started in to tease me right away. His niece Mary, Charlie's daughter, was staying with her grandmother when we arrived, and Johnny took more pleasure in teasing Mary and me than in anything else. He just could not leave us alone. Whenever he got me separated from Mary, Miss M or her mother would soon show up and call me away. In a subtle way, of course, but it always happened. He could tell such funny Irish jokes that I liked to be around him. One day he played a terrible joke on me. I washed all of my clothes and hung them out to dry and went on back upstairs to play checkers with Mary. The house stood on a corner with a generous yard all around it. The corner was very noisy because 2 main streetcar lines crossed there and it was a transfer point. About 2 hours after I had hung up my clothes, Mary and I became conscious of an unusual rumble of voices outside. We thought there had been an accident, so we rushed to the window to see. I was petrified with horror and shame. I had 3 pairs of panties out on the line, and now there was a little bunch of dandelions stuck in the clothespins holding each pair of my panties. Men and women, but men particularly, were hanging over the fence and laughing and joking. I knew right off that that was Johnny's work. Miss M was gone into town on a shopping trip, so I ran downstairs crying to tell her mother about it. Being Irish, she told me not to mind Johnny, to go out there and take them down. Unconscious of the trap, I rushed out of the kitchen door towards the line. Then the full horror struck me. In addition to the dandelions and the clothespins, there was a jaunty little nosegay of them pinned on 1 leg of a pair. Seeing me approach the line, the crowd snickered louder. I was covered with confusion and ran back inside, followed by guffaws. I told Mrs. M that I was not going to take down those clothes. Johnny was sitting by the kitchen table at the window and where he could take it all in. When I said I wouldn't take the clothes down, he got up and said, "Stop crying, Zora. I'll go take them down for you." That pacified me. He went outside and the noise turned into a riot. I looked out of the window and Johnny had the pear with the bouquet on it, holding it up in his hands and examining it from all angles, turning it slowly for the benefit of his audience. He felt it all over, as if somebody had them on, and kept on fooling like that until traffic was nearly tied up. I was inside throwing conniptions until his mother reminded me through her chuckles that nobody would know my panties from anybody else's. Those people out there did not know I was living. That was a good point, so I went on back upstairs. But I was mad with Johnny for hours. But he was so nice and jolly the next morning that I got over it. He led me into the deep corner of the yard to show me the lilacs in bloom. He talked on a while and asked me to loan him $2. He had to go and see about a job for the next day, he said. He would make $6 at it and pay me back the next night. I ran upstairs and got the money for him. He thanked me, but told me not to tell. I promised and went back inside. Johnny fooled around the house for perhaps an hour and went off. Noontime came and he was not back. Miss M and her mother looked worried at each other but did not say too much about it. We had supper about 6 o'clock and he still was not back. Neither of them ate anything this time. They looked at each other and looked more than worried. They were scared. They hustled Mary and me upstairs as soon as possible. They stayed down in the kitchen and mumbled and mumbled. After another hour or so, Miss M called me down and asked me, with her hands trembling, if I had loaned Johnny any money. I hesitated. I had promised not to tell. She pressed me, and seeing that there was something important about it, I told her about the $2. She called her mother weakly and collapsed in a chair. When her mother found out, she crumpled up and had to be put to bed. The outwardly gay house had turned into a spectral place because I had loaned Johnny $2. I couldn't see why. A message was hurriedly sent to Charlie, and around 10 o'clock, he arrived, and the mumbling went on downstairs. Finally, he decided to spend the night and stretched out on the couch in the living room. About midnight, I heard a terrible scream from Mrs. M's room. She slept on the first floor on account of her knee. She said it was rheumatism from scrubbing too many floors. Mary, Miss M, and I all bolted for the head of the stairs at the same time. Another scream, "Oh, Johnny!" from an old, anguished throat. Scuffling, bustling, short, angry sounds from Charlie. Running steps across the wide porch that all but surrounded the house, down the walk to the street, and away. We rushed into Mrs. M's room. She was lying in bed, her face contorted in pain and holding one shoulder with her hand. Tears were seeping from her eyes. The window onto the porch was open, and Charlie was not present in the house.
"Mama! Mama!" Miss M screamed. "What happened?"
The old woman kept her eyes closed and kept her hand on her shoulder. We waited, but she sobbed on with her lips pursed together. Miss M began to fuss around the head of the bed to make her mother more comfortable. Finally, she lifted the hand clutching the shoulder and revealed a great bluish-red bruise on the point of the shoulder and began to cry herself.
"Oh, Mama, how did you get hurt like that? Zora, you and Mary get me some hot water and witch hazel. Oh, Mama!"
There was a trudgy scuffling on the porch, and Charlie came in the door dragging Johnny. Charlie had a length of iron pipe in his hand, and his face was something terrible to look at. Miss M took it all in for a long moment, and without raising her voice, she asked, "Why did you do it, Johnny? Why?"
"Why do you waste your time asking this unfortunate brute such a question?" Charlie asked Miss M. "His crazy brain told him to do it. He's had liquor. And he went where it sent him." I have begged and begged Mama to put him back where he can't do any harm, but she won't listen to me. You heard me tonight begging her to let me call the police when he didn't come back. You begged her, but she wouldn't listen to either of us. I kept waiting for the phone to ring and say he had done something like this somewhere, but here?
Johnny stood there and never lifted his head. I felt terrible for having given him the money. But I realized, too, that at that time I didn't have the faintest notion what could happen. Instead of trying to watch him so closely that it couldn't happen, they should have warned me. Charlie said as much a minute later, but his sister explained that her mother would not let her do it. Her mother had said that she would keep an eye on him. Charlie took the clothesline and tied the passive Johnny hand and foot in the kitchen, then came back and forced his mother to talk. She said that she had not gone to sleep, really, lying there and worrying about her firstborn, when she heard the window near her bed being pushed up gently. At first, she was not sure, but as she turned over in bed, she could see the form of a man. She could see him stepping into the room. She was speechless with fright as the figure crept up to the head of the bed with the bludgeon half lifted. As the blow was about to descend, she knew from his breathing it was Johnny. She tried to duck, but the blow fell, luckily missing her head but landing on her shoulder. She screamed, and Johnny, seeing that he was not only recognized, but that the house was aroused, ran to the table at the foot of the bed and tried to pick up something there. But hearing the bustle overhead and Charlie bursting in from the living room, he ran to the window and fled, with Charlie at his heels. Charlie said that he had cornered him in a hedge at the other end of the block, still with the length of iron pipe in his hand. He had given up without a struggle and let himself be brought back. It turned out that Johnny had been after some very valuable art objects, grouped on the table at the foot of the bed. They belonged to a rich Bostonian who was in Europe at the time. Mrs. M. had once worked for her, and when she went abroad, she had left the priceless things there rather than at her house, which might be burglarized. She did not dream that anyone would be tempted to burglarize the M. home, so she had entrusted them to her former and trusted servant. No one except the family knew that they were there, and so Mrs. M. had covered them over on the table and felt safe. I learned that Johnny had helped to kill a man in a robbery attempt when he was 17. He and his pal had done the thing, but had been caught before the robbery was completed. The older boy was executed, but Johnny's sentence was commuted to life because of his youth. He had remained in Charlestown prison for 18 years, and no matter what the weather or the circumstances might be, his mother had never missed a visiting day, nor ever failed to take him something. She was a widow a second time when he committed the murder. She was out in domestic service, but her love never flagged. Sometimes money was so scarce that she could not afford to pay transportation to Charlestown and take him something, too. When it got like that, she took him something and walked. Her passion was to free her son. She renewed her promise to him every time she saw him. This went on for 17 years. Then the man whose cook she had been for 15 years became governor of Massachusetts. He knew his cook's heart, so a few months after he was inaugurated, he opened the prison doors for Johnny M. He could not grant him a pardon because the crime had been too heinous. The best that he could do was to parole him in care of his faithful mother. Her second son had finished high school and finally worked himself into the fire department. Her daughter's beauty and her voice had gotten her a scholarship at the New England Conservatory of Music. They were on their way, and now her eldest son was free again. All she had to do was watch him and see to it that he got hold of no whiskey.
Johnny was good-natured and easy to manage as long as he was sober. But he became a savage, lusting to kill as soon as whiskey touched his brain. Kill to get more money to buy more whiskey to drive him to kill again. Those art objects represented not beauty to him, but money for whiskey and around the circle again. The fact that it was the woman who had borne him who was standing between him and the money which the treasure would bring meant nothing after he had taken a drink. I went back upstairs that night while she still whimpered and begged Charles, "Don't call the police to take the poor unfortunate thing back to prison. He told me time and time again that he would die if he was ever taken back, Charlie. It would be murder, Charlie. Charlie, please don't do a thing like that." Charles pointed out that while Johnny was a poor unfortunate, he was too dangerous to be at large. Even if he did not later kill his own mother, the family would be responsible if the animal killed somebody else. It was too awful to think about. Perhaps it would be the kindest thing to let him die in prison. His mother had to give up her job just to sit around and watch Johnny. He, Charlie, had to deny his wife and children things to take care of his mother and brother. His sister, with her lovely voice, had to cut her training short to make money to help support them. His mother was willing to risk the lives of innocent people and the futures of her two younger children for the sake of that inhuman wretch, and so on. But the morning found her just as stubborn, and Charles went on back home. That afternoon, a telegram came from Miss M. to report for rehearsal in Reading, Pennsylvania, and we left that night. I never saw the house or Johnny again, and Miss M. never mentioned him to me again. But from then on, I knew what was haunting her face, why she had been putting off marriage with her sweetheart. About 4 months later, she met a wealthy businessman of Newark, and I could tell that she was sunk. It all happened very suddenly but gloriously. She told me that now that she was going to be married and leave the stage, she did not want me to work for anyone else in the business. In fact, she thought that I should not be working at all. I ought to be in school. She said she thought I had a mind and that it would be a shame for me not to have any further training. She wished that she herself could go abroad to study. But that was definitely out of the question now. The deep reservoir of things inside her gave off a sigh. We were in Northern Virginia then, and moving towards Baltimore. When we got there, she inquired about schools, gave me a big, bare full hug, and what little money she could spare, and told me to keep in touch with her. She would do whatever she could to help me out. That was the way we parted. I had been with her for 18 months, and though neither of us realized it, I had been in school all that time. I had loosened up in every joint and expanded in every direction. I had done some reading, not as much as before, but more discriminate reading. The tenor was a Harvard man who had traveled on the continent. He always had books along with him and offered them to me more and more. The first time I asked to borrow one, he looked at me in a way that said, "What for?" But when he found that I really read it and enjoyed it, he relaxed and began to hand them to me gruffly. He never acted as if he liked it, but I knew better. That was just the Harvard in him. Then there was the music side. They broke me into good music, that is, the classics, if you want to put it that way. There was no conscious attempt to do this. Just from being around, I became familiar with Gilbert and Sullivan and the best parts of the light opera field. Grand opera, too, for all of the leads had backgrounds of private classical instruction as well as conservatory training. Even the bit performers and the chorus had some kind of formal training in voice, and most of them played the piano. It was not unusual for some of the principals to drop down at the piano after a matinee performance and begin to sing arias from grand opera, sing them with a wistfulness. The arias which they would sing at the Metropolitan or La Scala, as they had once hoped actively, and still hoped passively, even as the hair got thinner and the hips got heavier. Others, dressed for the street, would drift over and ease into the singing. Thus I would hear solos, duets, quartets, and sextets from the best-known operas. They would eagerly explain to me what they were when I asked. They would go on to say how Caruso, Farrar, Mary Garden, Trentini, Schumann, Heinck, Matzenauer, and so forth had interpreted this or that piece and demonstrated by singing. Perhaps that was their trouble. They were not originators, but followers of originators. Anyway, it was perfectly glorious for me, though I am sure nobody thought of it that way. I just happened to be there while they released their inside dreams. I can see now how capable these people were, who were taking light opera to the sticks. For instance, the opening night in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, was so riotous that the house manager came backstage and said it was certain to be held over. The company decided on the off chance to prepare the Chocolate Soldier for the new week. When the curtain went up the next Monday night, a very smooth performance of The Soldier was unveiled to the public. They did the same thing with The Firefly in Bridgeport, Connecticut later on. It was very beautiful, but tough on me. I got so sick of holding sides and feeding cues that I was ready to throw an acre of fits. But it did teach me the lesson that you can do what you have to do. Like that tree-climbing rabbit of Uncle Remus, who was just bludged to climb that tree. A hound was on his tail, and he had to do the impossible, and he did it. More than that, I saw 30-odd people made up of all classes and races living a communal life. There were little touches of professional jealousy and a catty crack now and then, but let sickness or trouble touch any member, and the whole cast rallied around to help out. It was a marvelous thing to see. There were a few there from good families and well-to-do homes who slept in shabby hotels and made meals on sandwiches without a murmur. From what they said and did, you would think they were as poor as the rest. With all branches of Anglo-Saxon, Irish, three Jews and one Negro together in a huddle, and all friendly, there were a lot of racial gags. Everybody was so sure that nobody hesitated to pull them. It was all taken in good part. Naturally, all of the Negro gags were pulled on me. There were enough of the others to divide things up. For instance, one night, Miss M. cut her eyes in my direction slyly, began to talk about blondes, brunettes, and brunettes. They gagged me so much before overture was called that it made Miss M. go out there and cut a hog. In her long recitative in the first act of Pinafore, where the heroine mulls over what she is leaving in her father's house and what she is going to in marrying the poor hero, she mentions dirty children crying and dingy clothes a-drying. That night she frightened herself nearly to death by chanting in full rich tones about dingy children crying. The audience, no doubt, began to wonder what kind of a marriage it was she was contemplating. But the whole experience on that job gave me an approach to racial understanding. It was easy to keep on feeling that way. Furthermore, it discouraged any sensitiveness on my part, so that I am still not conscious of my race, no matter where I may go. I found out, too, that you are bound to be jostled in the crowded street of life, that in itself need not be dangerous unless you have the open razors of personal vanity in your pants pocket. The passers-by don't hurt you, But if you go around like that, they make you hurt yourself. The experience had matured me in other ways. I had seen. I had been privileged to see folks substituting love for failure of career. I would listen to one and another pour out their feelings, sitting on a stool backstage between acts and scenes. Then, too, I had seen careers filling up the empty holes left by love and covering up the wreck of things internal. Those experiences, though vicarious, made me see things and think. And now, at last, it was all over. It was not at all clear to me how I was going to do it, but I was going back to school. One minute I felt brave and fine about it all. The wish to be back in school had never left me. But alone by myself and feeling it over, I was scared. Before this job, I had been lonely. I had been bare and bony of comfort and love. Working with these people, I had been sitting by a warm fire for a year and a half and gotten used to the feel of peace. Now I was to take up my pilgrim stick and go outside again. Maybe it would be different now. Seven of my unhappy visions had passed me and bowed. The seventh one, the house that needed paint, that had threatened me with so much suffering that I used to sit up in bed, sodden with agony, had passed. I had fled from it to put on the blue poplin dress. At least that was not before me anymore. I took a firm grip on the only weapon I had, hope, and set my feet. Maybe everything would be all right from now on. Maybe. Well, I put on my shoes, and I started. Chapter 9. School Again. Back out walking on flypaper again. Money was what I needed to get back in school. I could have saved a lot of money if I had received it. But theatrical salaries being so uncertain, I did not get mine half the time. I had it when I had it, but when it was not paid, I never worried. But now I needed it. Miss M was having her troubles, trying to help her folks, she informed me by mail. So I never directly asked her for anything more. I had no resentment either. It had all been very pleasant. I tried waiting on table and made a good waitress when my mind was on it, which was not often. I resented being patronized more than the monotony of the job. Those presumptuous cut-eye looks and supposed to be accidental touches on the thigh to see how I took to things. Men at the old game of stealing a feel. People who paid for a quarter meal left me a nickel tip and then stood outside the door and nodded their heads for me to follow on and hear the rest of the story. But I was lacking in curiosity. I was not worrying so much about virtue. The thing just did not call me. There was neither the beauty of love nor material advantage in it for me. After all, what is the use in having swine without pearls? Some educated men sat and talked about the things I was interested in, but if I seemed to listen, looked at me as much to say, "What would that mean to you?" Then in the midst of other difficulties, I had to get sick. Not a sensible sickness for poor folks to have, no. I must get down with appendicitis and have to have an operation right away. So it was the free ward of the Maryland General Hospital for me. When I was taken up to the amphitheater for the operation, I went up there placing a bet with God. I did not fear death. Nobody would miss me very much, and I had no treasures to leave behind me, so I would not go out of life looking backwards on that account. But I bet God that if I lived, I would try to find out the vague directions whispered in my ears and find the road it seemed that I must follow. How? When? Why? What? All those answers were hidden from me. So 2 o'clock that day when they dressed me for surgery and took me up there in that room with the northern light and many windows, I stepped out of the chair before the nurse could interfere, walked to a window, and took a good look out over Baltimore and the world as far as I could see, resigned myself to fate, and unaided, climbed upon the table and breathed deeply when the ether cone was placed over my nose. I scared the doctor and the nurses by not waking up until 9 o'clock that night, but otherwise I was all right. I was alive. So I had to win my bet with God. Soon, I had another waitress's job, trying to save money again, but I was only jumping up and down in my own foot tracks. I tried several other things, but always I had that feeling that you have in a dream of trying to run and sinking to your knees at every step in soft, sticky mud. And this mud not only felt obscene to my feet, it smelled filthy to my nose. How to pull out? How then did I get back to school? I just went. I got tired of trying to get the money to go. My clothes were practically gone. Nickeling and diming along was not getting me anywhere. So I went to the night high school in Baltimore. And that did something for my soul. There I met the man who was to give me the key to certain things. In English, I was under Dwight O.W. Holmes. There is no more dynamic teacher anywhere under any skin. He radiates newness and nerve and says to your mind, "There is something wonderful to behold just ahead. Let's go see what it is." He is a pilgrim to the horizon. Anyway, that is the way he struck me. He made the way clear. Something about his face killed the drabness and discouragement in me. I felt that the thing could be done. I turned in written work and answered questions like everybody else, but he took no notice of me particularly, until one night in the study of English poets, he read Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. You must get him to read it for you sometime. He is not a pretty man, but he has the face of a scholar. Not dry and set-like, but fire flashes from his deep-set eyes. His high-bridged but sort of bent nose over his thin-lipped mouth. Well, the whole thing reminds you of some old Roman, like Cicero, Caesar, or Virgil, in tan skin. That night, he liquefied the immortal grains of Coleridge and let the fountain flow. I do not know whether something in my attitude attracted his attention or whether what I had done previously made him direct the stream at me. Certainly, every time he lifted his eyes from the page, he looked right into my eyes. It did not make me see him particularly, but it made me see the poem. That night seemed queer, but I am so visual-minded that all the other senses induce pictures in me. Listening to Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Kubla Khan for the first time, I saw all that the poet had meant for me to see with him, and infinite cosmic things besides. I was not of the workaday world for days after Mr. Holmes's voice had ceased. This was my world, I said to myself, and I shall be in it and surrounded by it if it is the last thing I do on God's green dirt ball. But he did something more positive than that. He stopped me after class and complimented me on my work. He did something else. He never asked me anything about myself, but he looked at me and toned his voice in such a way that I felt he knew all about me. His whole manner said, no matter about the difficulties past and present, step on it. I went back to class only twice after that. I did not say a word to him about my resolve, but the next week, I went out to Morgan College to register in the high school department. William Pickens, a Negro, was the dean there, and he fooled me too. I was prepared to be all scared of him and his kind. I had no money and no family to refer to. I just went and he talked to me. He gave me a brief examination and gave me credit for 2 years' work in high school and assigned me to a class. He was just as understanding as Dwight Holmes, in a way. Knowing that I had no money, he evidently spoke to his wife, because she sent for me a few days later and told me enthusiastically that she had a job for me that would enable me to stay in school. Dr. Baldwin, a white clergyman and one of the trustees of Morgan, had a wife with a broken hip. He wanted a girl to stay at the house, help her dress in the morning, undress at night, and generally look after her. There was no need for anyone except in the morning and at night. He would give me a home and $2 a week. The way Mrs. Pickens described the work to me, I could tell she knew I would be glad to accept the job, and I was. So I went to live with the Baldwins. The family consisted of the minister, his wife, and his daughter, Miss Maria, who seemed to be in her 30s and unmarried. They had a great library, and I waded in. I acted as if the books would run away. I remember committing to memory Gray's Elegy in a country churchyard overnight, lest I never get a chance to read it again. Next, I learned the Ballad of Reading Jail and started on the Rubaiyat. It would be dramatic in a Cinderella way if I were to say that the well-dressed students at school snubbed me and shoved me around, but that I studied hard and triumphed over them. I did study hard because I realized that I was 3 years behind schedule, and then again, study has never been hard to me. Then, too, I had hundreds of books under my skin already. Not selected reading, all of it. Some of it could be called trashy. I had been through Nick Carter, Horatio Alger, Bertha M. Clay, and the whole slew of dime novelists, in addition to some really constructive reading. I do not regret the trash. It has harmed me in no way. It was a help, because acquiring the reading habit early is the important thing. Taste and natural development will take care of the rest later on. Nobody shoved me around. There were 18 people in my class. 6 of them were boys, good-looking, well-dressed girls from Baltimore's best Negro families were classmates of mine. Ethel Cummings, the daughter of a very successful lawyer, Bernice Naylor, whose father was a big preacher, the Hughes girls, Bernice and Gwendolyn, who were not only beautiful, but whose family is distinguished in the professions all over America. Mary Jane Watkins of New York, now a dentist and considered the most sex-appealing thing, with her lush figure and big eyes and soft skin, and all of the girls in my class passed for pretty. It was said to be not only the best-looking class on the campus, college or prep, but the best-looking ever to happen together. You see, Rosa Brown, who was easily the most luscious piece of gal meat in all colored Baltimore, was in that class, too. She had not only lovely eyes set in a cameo-like face, but shining, beautiful black curls that fell easily to her waist. She has done well by herself, too. She is now married to Tanner Moore, a prosperous lawyer of Philadelphia. Townhouse, cars, and country place, and things like that. Well, here was this class of pretty girls and snappy boys. The girls were in the majority, but what we had of boys were in demand in town and on campus. The class knew it caused a lot of trouble, too, as the college girls were always growling about that prep class grabbing off the college men. They passed a rule about it, but it did not help matters. They, the college girls, just got left out of things, themselves, while the prep girls romped on. And here I was, With my face looking like it had been chopped out of a knot of pine wood with a hatchet on somebody's off day, sitting up in the middle of all this pretty. To make things worse, I had only one dress, a change of underwear, and one pair of tan Oxfords.